Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast and across the middle part of our country as well. On Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, AirAmericaRadio.com, and CRN Digital on cable systems all across the United States as well. Our quote for the day, the man who reads nothing at all is better educated than the man who reads nothing but newspapers, Thomas Jefferson. That in the middle of Jefferson's battles with the newspapers. He went through a bitter period there. Later on in the program, I'll be asking conservative, we're coming up right now. And Jeffrey Feldman, later on in the program, with Frame Shop is Open, is dropping by. And Larry Scott, a VA watchdog, will be with us in the third hour of our program about the VA data heist and latest update on that. Right now, Harry Binswanger. Hey, Harry.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Just great. Harry is with you specialize in philosophy and capitalism with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Ayn Rand Institute, of course, the holders of the holy grail of objectivism these days.
Yep.
That philosophy that property rights are above all else and that has made its way into contemporary libertarian and conservative thinking, although I realize you guys are neither libertarians nor conservatives.
Right.
Our question for the day, why should we destroy the Arctic tundra just to protect profits for the oil industry?
To protect profits for the oil industry. Profit is a right. Profit is a good thing. Profit is the source of all economic growth. Profit represents man's conquest of the environment, which should be conquered and made to serve his ends.
That's quite a mouthful, Harry.
Yeah, I thought I'd get a lot in right at the beginning there.
You did. You done good.
Thanks.
So are you suggesting that if I make a profit, let's say I sell you something, and it makes you very sick, but I made a profit on it, that your sickness, your right to wellness, shall we say, does not trump my right to a profit?
There's no such thing as right to wellness. The issue is, was there voluntary consent or was there fraud? If I sell you a hamburger laced with poison, that's murder. If I sell something that makes you sick because of a physical cause that I was negligent in not removing, and I represented to you that this was safe, then that's a fraudulent action. That's force. That's not voluntary consent. I'm talking about profit, which means that you take inputs which have a certain value on the market, and you work them up until they have a higher value.
So to use, and I think it's one of the reasons why it's important for us to have this conversation about this right now, Al Gore is just being, you know, viciously attacked by the there's no such thing as global warming folks out there, funded in large part by the oil industry. And the whole debate about this is coming to the fore. Plus, oil is now above $50, $55 a barrel. By law, once the price of oil goes above $55 a barrel, all oil on federal land becomes free to the oil companies if they simply have permission to drill for it. And therefore, they are salivating at the prospect of getting the oil up in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So if we were to use, Harry, your values model, your set of values, which you just did a very good job of articulating, would it not be proper to say that drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge represents one of two things? It either represents a legitimate compromise between harm to the environment or, you know, even perhaps harm is too loaded a word, a modification of the environment in exchange for a product that we need and profits that you're saying are a good thing. Or it represents fraud in as much as an industry is trying to get its hands on that oil and it's selling us phony reasons for trying to get its hands on that oil. Do you accept that those are two possible realities?
No. I don't accept either one of those. The first one is closest to what I would accept. The man has a moral obligation to transform the environment to make his life better. That's what morality is all about, reshaping matter to serve human needs. It is not a compromise to modify the environment. Man's survival consists of modifying the environment, as indeed every organism.
So then the third option would be, if we drill in Anwar and it kills off a whole bunch of species and destroys one of the most ecologically fragile places in the entire planet, that's a good thing. Plus, we get the oil, and that's a good thing.
Well, I wouldn't accept the characterization of killing off a lot of species. There's no species that would be killed off. But again, occasional die-off, about, you know, one a century, it's fine with me. I don't miss the dodo or the saber-toothed tiger. I'd rather have cheap oil, cheap gasoline. You know, I'm a progressive in this sense. I'm like the left used to be until mid-century. I think that progress, increasing wealth, is crucially important. That's one difference from objectivism and of many, and the religious right. Of course, objectivism is atheist, as anyone who's read Atlas Shrugged knows. But we're for man's survival on this earth, not pie in the sky, as the left used to put it.
But Harry Binswanger, if man's survival on this earth is being potentially harmed by the toxic exhaust that is produced whenever oil is burned, and I think you'll acknowledge that there are poisons that are produced when oil is burned. If man's survival on this earth is potentially harmed by altering the environment as a consequence of all the carbon dioxide we're pulling out of the ground and putting into the atmosphere, or all the carbon in various forms, carbon dioxide, methane, and other forms, then shouldn't those be part of the equation?
I'm a little hard put to answer that because I don't agree with the premise, but if I take it on your description, yes. Anything, you have to be long range. Anything that threatens future survival is a bad thing.
Then why are you in favor of drilling in Anwar?
I don't agree that the scare, the alarmism of the environmental movement is at all warranted. I think it's all the reaction of the old left now become the new left.
Now, hang on just a second here, Harry Binswanger. First of all, your characterization of yourself as a progressive, I just have to challenge. I'm sorry, but or maybe, you know, you're saying the term from the 19th century, although I would say even then those progressives were mostly involved in labor unions and labor movement, which I know that you don't think should have power. But in any case, the Science Magazine, which, you know, the publication of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS.
Yeah.
One of the most solid scientific organizations.
One of the most highly politicized. One of the most highly politicized since the 60s.
Takes no political positions whatsoever.
Oh, no, it's completely leftist.
They have never endorsed legislation.
Please, I've read the Science Magazine and the AAAS since 1964. And they...
I've been a member of the AAAS for a decade, Harry. I have never seen a single... I've never even seen an editorial that talked about politics.
Well, may I... You know, it's possible that... You know, the way we think we don't speak with an accent, it's everybody else who speaks with an accent. If you see things that you agree with, it doesn't look like ideology. It looks like, well, this is just
communism. Okay, well, let's say for a moment, Harry, that the AAAS is a communist organization. It's as left-wing as they can get.
Mm-hmm.
They did an analysis of all the peer review articles published in publications mm-hmm. that require a peer review, where scientists have to submit things to their peers and actually back up their science. Nearly 1,000 peer review articles over the last 15 years on climate change and global warming. And not one of those articles suggested that there was any, quote, debate on this. And all of them suggested that global warming is happening and that man-made emissions, which in large part from oil, played some role in it. The debate is what the extent of that role is.
That's not possible. That's not possible. I know Richard Linzer at MIT, was it Fred Schmidt? There are scientists.
Fred Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's never been published in a peer-reviewed publication.
And Richard Linzer has.
Not to the best.
And it's just not possible that there are thousands and not one questioning it. I don't believe that for a minute. That's just impossible. Because there were 17,000 signed, but, you know, do we want to get off on this? There are 17,000 scientists who signed a web petition. Now, these are people who claim they have science degrees.
Yeah.
Surely there must be two of those people who published,
yeah,
you know, claiming that global warming doesn't exist. Now, my position on global warming is I hope it's true, but I have no reason to believe it is at present.
Can you hang on? Can you stick around for a little bit? Okay, just hold that thought, and we'll continue with this. And also, let me invite our callers to get in on this if you'd like to talk with Harry. Harry Binswanger, he's with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Our number, 1-866-440-8466, and you can drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com. It's 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartmann program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
I wouldn't screw up the environment or the money for retirement like the liberals complain. I'd impress all my poo-pooers, shocking all the evildoers if I only had a brain. Now I'd pronunciate much better, honor liberties to the letter for the folks that we detain. And when the world called me a baddie, I wouldn't run off to my daddy if I only had a brain.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. Harry Binswanger from the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND, with us on the line. And Harry, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Let's see what our callers have to say on this. The board is lit up. And Robert in Burlington, Vermont. Robert, you're live with Harry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This guest speaker, Harry? Suggests a disconnect between man and nature that is, or humans and nature that is bizarre to me. He suggests that anything that we do is okay. He takes a long-term view that what we're doing right now, in fact, is not having the very effect on doing away with man. We have disease in our own country as a result of the way that we produce our food and the way that we burn our gasoline, and the amount of disease that we have is just as a result of our connection to our agriculture is undeniable. And so the guy, he seems to just bury his head in the sand when it comes to science, and you don't even need a scientific publication to verify this. Nutritional disease is running rampant as a way.
Okay, can I step in now that you've talked for longer than I've had a chance to talk in the whole show? This is why I call myself a progressive. Because I'm in favor of industry, I'm in favor of agriculture, big agriculture.
You're not a progressive here, you're a corporatist.
I'm a corporatist, yes. I'm in favor.
It's a throwback.
I'm in favor. No, you're the throwback. You're saying that the progress in technology and science are just leading to disaster. We didn't have nutritional disease before.
I didn't say that. I said
capitalism
industry
and
was
science,
leading to
right?
disaster. I didn't say science was. I said industry was. The choices that they've made based on the dollar is what's not the fact that the technology doesn't have the
Robert, you made your point here. Just pause for a minute and let Harry get a thought out.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. The reason I call myself a progressive is not because I have anything to do with the old Marxists who hide under the term progressive. I'm in favor of progress. And
you're calling me a Marxist, Harry?
No, I'm not calling you a Marxist. Are you?
Well, I don't think so, and I call myself a progressive.
Well, the term progressive.
We're gonna get stuck in semantics here all afternoon if that's where we're gonna go. I mean, Robert makes a good point. You're suggesting that humans are somehow different than nature, and I think that most people would say, "Hey, we're animals."
I'm suggesting we are animals, and we are part of nature, and our specific ecological niche is to use our minds, our brains. That's what we evolved to, you know, create a special means of survival for us. Our means of survival is altering nature, building buildings, taming fire, killing the woolly mastodon for food.
But, Harry, when you've got an institution that's altering nature, not to make life, and thank you for the call, our caller in Vermont, not necessarily to make life better for people, but to make a profit, which is the legal requirement of a corporation.
That's the same thing. To make life better and to make a profit are one and the same thing.
I see. But I thought, my understanding was that profit only benefits those people who are shareholders in the corporation because share in the profit.
Oh, no. Profit is growth. Profit means taking something that is valued by the public at a certain dollar amount and creating something that is valued by that same public at more than that amount. So it's a value creation for the world, for the market. And
growth, in your opinion, is the ultimate high value.
Excuse me?
And growth, in your opinion, is the ultimate high value.
Production, yeah.
Okay. Let me just play a clip here for you, and we'll get your response after we come back from the break, and then we'll go back to our phone lines, Harry. Listen to this. This is an ad from Adbusters. Whoops. Hang on just a second here.
For years, economists have defined the economic health of a country by its gross domestic product. Trouble is, every time a forest falls, the GDP goes up. With every oil spill, the GDP goes up. Every time a cancer patient is diagnosed, the GDP goes up. Is this how we measure economic progress? Economists must learn to subtract.
Profit and GDP aren't the only values here.
Nope, they aren't. I couldn't hear all of that commercial, but it sounded pretty sinister. Clip. I shouldn't say commercial.
Yeah, it was a commercial, actually, from Adbusters. And the point that they make is that when somebody's diagnosed with cancer, that's worth about $250,000 to the economy and represents economic growth.
No, it's worth a net loss to the economy because the economy includes the person who's hurt as well as the...
And they pointed out that when there's an oil spill... That when there's an oil spill, that it increases economic growth because you've now got a cleanup industry. I'll let you answer on the way back. Well, Harry, you'll get your chance. We're out of time. It's 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's a strange old game to learn slow. One step forward and it's back to go. You're standing on the throttle, standing on the brake. In the groove till you make a mistake. Sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug. Sometimes it all comes together, sometimes you're a fool in love.
And welcome back, my friends. 964 days, 12 hours, 25 minutes, 43 seconds, until George Bush leaves office voluntarily, assuming that there's no impeachment, 34 minutes past the hour. On the Tom Hartman Radio program, we're talking with Harry Binswanger of the Ayn Rand Institute. Harry, we run a hard clock on this program, just as a heads up. At 21 minutes past the hour, at 27 minutes and 20 seconds after the hour, at 45 minutes and 20 seconds after the hour, and at 57 minutes and 20 seconds after the hour, the music starts, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. So I didn't mean to cut you off there at the end. We just, you know, got to do commercial breaks, and it's a fine thing because it gives us an opportunity to stay on the air. So you wanted to reply to my suggestion and the one from adbusters.org that for example, a cancer, your point of cancer I think is well taken, but for example, they said, you know, every time there's an oil slick, every time there's an oil spill, the GDP goes up because now you have invented a new industry, cleaning up oil spills, going up to Alaska and taking care of birds.
No. This is a fundamental fallacy of economics that Henry Hazlitt wrote a nice little book about called Economics in One Lesson. And he takes the case of a hoodlum throws a rock through a plate glass window, and people stand around and say, oh, well, this will create employment for the glass company, and then the glass company will spend its funds to order new equipment, and that'll create further employment. This is really a good thing. But it isn't, as Hazlitt points out, because the store owner has lost that value. It's a net loss when there's destruction of wealth. So I think...
But an oil spill only destroys habitat, so it's essentially the same thing as drilling an ANWR.
You said that an oil spill creates wealth because it creates the opportunity to spend money for, you know, on
to take care
up.
Of the dying seabirds. And you're suggesting, screw seabirds.
If only a meteor would hit the Earth, look at all the opportunities for creating wealth that there must be. If only there could be a war that destroy the Earth, destroy the
then we're agreeing.
That's a total fallacy.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And yet you've got conservatives out there saying that GDP and profits are the measure of progress. And yet, as you just said, just because something increases profits, just because something increases GDP doesn't mean it's a good thing.
Tom, I was being sarcastic. I was trying to do a reductio ad absurdum, that the destruction of wealth is not the creation of wealth. What is wealth? Wealth is physical objects that have value to man's life.
Or intellectual objects. Yeah.
Excuse me?
Or intellectual objects.
Or
Harry, let's get the phone lines. I got a bunch of callers who want to talk to you, and I don't want to...
Can I just finish the thought?
Sure.
When those objects are destroyed or changed to lose their value, that is the loss of wealth. The fact that people can then stop making the new products they were going to make and repair the damage is not a creation of wealth. It's a loss of wealth.
Okay. Barry in Teaneck, New Jersey. You're live with Harry Binswanger of Ayn Rand.
Yeah, hi. If he is saying that, if he equates corporate profit with public good, is he saying that as tobacco companies profit, that public good is better served?
Well, no, because unknown to people at the time they began smoking, it hurts your life, it hurts wealth.
But you said
the
that
people who get sick. But now let's suppose that you decide for you, you'd rather smoke and shorten your life expectancy, not your necessary life.
No, but your premise was that as corporations do well, public is better served.
As corporations do well in the do well in honest production of goods and services.
That's an honest production.
Yeah, but it was a mistake. Corporations can make profits by something that involves.
So, Harry, you think the tobacco companies should be shut down?
In other words,
and then
absolutely not. I smoke a pipe myself, but I think it should be voluntary. And a lot of people wouldn't have started smoking if they had known 30, 40 years ago what the risks are, as they know now. Now, those are just risks. It isn't that a cigarette is going to kill you.
So what you're saying is that as corporations grow, public good is served unless it's a mistake and decided by you that it's a mistake.
No.
So who decides what's a mistake?
The people who use the product and wish they hadn't.
Well, who makes that decision?
But they wish they hadn't as they're dying. I mean, isn't there something to be said for noticing harms in advance and preventing them?
Well, sure.
Yeah, but that's,
and anything that you know.
So I'm suggesting with regard to ANWR that we're noticing a harm here coming, and let's prevent that harm before it happens.
No, exactly.
You're not noticing a harm to a human life.
We're talking about harm to the planet. Barry, thank you for the call.
Hey, there's no harm to human life in ANWR. No one's ever even going up there to see it. And there's no harm to human life in offshore drilling. There's no harm to life in increasing oil production. Let's industrialize this country, damn it.
Okay, James in Tampa Bay, Florida. You're live with Harry.
Hi. I just wanted to dispel real quick the thing about the 17,000 signees. I read that as well, and if you look at it, quite a few of them are not even like high-level quote scientists. There's high school teachers and all that on there, for one. Two, it was signed several years ago, and since that time, a lot of them have come back and said, oh, wait a second, I've looked at the science, and I really do believe that global warming is happening. Please take my name off the list.
Well, here's why. Yeah, those Thanks, are good James. Points. Those are valid points. Here's why I'm skeptical. It's part of a whole political movement. It's why I'm basically skeptical. But what about the fact that global warming has been touted for 18 years now and nothing's happened?
Yeah, you tell that to the people in New Orleans.
Katrina had nothing to do with global warming. Hurricanes are not.
How do you know that?
I've read on it.
No scientist would say that. No scientist would say any hurricane does or does not have anything to do with global warming.
Yes, they say there's an Atlantic cycle. There's two facts. There's an Atlantic cycle, which every 20 years shifts from bad to better. And we're in the 40s to the 60s, hurricanes were quite terrible. And then from the 60s to, maybe I have my numbers wrong here, but the 40s to 60s were bad, and they expect the 00 to the 020s to be bad. There were fewer hurricanes in the Pacific, same amount of world energy. There were fewer in the Pacific, and they shifted over to Atlanta. And Katrina was not even that big a hurricane. It happened to hit a city which, thanks to socialist legislation, had built levees through the use of government rather than private property owners protecting their property. And so the thing crumbled.
I would submit to you that those levies by government were the private property owners getting together and saying, we're going to tax ourselves and produce these levies.
Oh, that'd be fine if they just taxed themselves. That would be assessing themselves, but they tax people who didn't want to pay those taxes. Taxation is force. Taxation is theft.
Okay, Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're live with Harry Binswanger.
Hi. Hey, Harry. First of all, I wanted to say I really appreciate your integrity and honesty in defending your position. It's refreshing. I disagree with you 100%, but at least you're honest, right?
Thank you.
Just two quick questions. I'd like you to define capitalism. I believe you think it's a governmental system and not an economic system, and Webster's Dictionary, I think, disagrees with you. And also, defining the word progressive. Teddy Roosevelt was one, creating the national parks. Is he a Marxist? So define capitalism, which we all think should be subservient to our democratically, you know, democratic form of government. Let me hear you define capitalism.
Capitalism is a socio-economic system based on the recognition of individual rights, including property rights, in which all property is privately owned. That's Ayn Rand's definition.
Right.
So it is broader than
Webster's.
It's broader than just economics because, as we found out in the last couple of decades, economics cannot exist separate from politics.
So, Harry, if capitalism is also a political system, that means that the people who own the capital own the politics.
No, the politics is not a matter of owning money. The politics is who controls the government.
Right, my point.
That's decided. Well, first of all, there's a constitution that spells out individual rights, as our constitution basically did with a few flaws. And then there's voting on the administration, on who the personnel is. That is not a matter of wealth. That's a matter of citizenship.
It's a matter of wealth if the Supreme Court in Boston versus Bilotti decides that cash equals free speech and the person with the most cash has the right to have the most speech.
That's the correct decision. I wish it were upheld. I wish we could repeal all the laws against campaign financing.
Am I still on?
Yeah, you are, Tom.
Yeah, you know, our Constitution already protects individual rights. The Bill of Rights already did that. And that is superior to the capitalist system, which is an economic system. I know you don't like that, but that's what it is.
Well, let me try and draw the connection, because I favor the original American Constitution as it was originally set up.
This would be pre-Civil War. Harry, we have to take a break. You can wrap it up after the break. Hang on. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom, thanks for the call. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. We'll be right back. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I lost my vote now. Do you know where did my ballot go?
up a mess when they change the rules without my consent. Don't wanna be nobody's experiment.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, smalldog.com, the website. You get the latest iPods and all things Macintosh. And the organic wine company, Eco Wine, 1-888-ECO-WINE, fine imported French organic wines. We're talking with Harry Binswanger of AynRand.org, the Ayn Rand Institute. Harry, you want to finish your point? I got nine callers, and we've got about 4 minutes.
Like to give the overview of where I'm coming from, and it's just what you were saying in your commercials. iPods and wine. Not exactly wine, women, and song, but life is an end in itself. There is no God. There is no afterlife. The good in this world is to create value, and our means of doing that is technology.
But our question is, why should we destroy the Arctic tundra for oil industry profits?
Because it's there.
Because it's there. Okay.
Right.
All righty. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, and Angelo in Bainbridge Island, Washington. Hey, Angelo.
Hi. How you guys doing?
Good. What's up?
Not much. I wanted to clarify Mr. Binswanger's definition of morality. From what I understand, your definition, sir, is a man's domination over nature. I just wanted to maybe get you to clarify that.
Yeah, the morality itself is just a code of values to guide man's choices and actions. I said that the essence of morality is productiveness, which means reshaping nature to serve human purposes. So if you are out in the woods and you break off a branch and use it as a spear to catch a fish, that's good. That's a good thing. If you build a nuclear reactor because you want cheaper and cleaner energy than coal and oil, that's good. Okay, go ahead.
So I guess our main differences, or where we're coming from, is, yeah, I just heard you say there's no God, you don't believe in God. I mean, I guess my definition of morality would be looking out for the well-being of everyone in our society, or in the world, really, but especially for, you know, the least among us.
Why do you hold that?
Well, because I feel that that if we can bring up the least among us, that's going to better the society as a whole.
It's also the traditional value of humans,
yeah.
Harry. I mean, if you look back at humans over the last 100,000 years, virtually all cultures have held that as their highest moral value.
I know. That's why I consider you guys to be the reactionaries, and I'm the progressive. I'm saying let's throw off Christianity. Let's throw off the Sermon on the Mount.
To hell with the least among us.
They're
just getting in the way. Let's just drive over them with our Hummers.
Let's look at the world afresh without the prejudice of Christian ethics.
Okay.
And ask what are values.
Okay. I guess, can I make a point real quick, Mr. Binswanger?
It's going to have to be really fast because I got to move along to another caller here, Angela.
Okay, I guess real quick, Mr. Binswanger, please. My problem with business in America, I think, is our lack of morality in business. I guess you can say Walmart in America, I feel like they screw over the American worker, where you have Walmart in Germany.
Their morality is founded in the idea of profits above all, which is what Harry's subscribing
to. That's right.
We've been there and we've gone through that. I got to move along. Mitch in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Hey, Mitch.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good.
When I was a kid, I read Ayn Rand, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I found it to be a very fanciful book. Alice Shrugged was my first one, and that's the one I'm basically talking about. Her ideology basically was excellent. It's beautiful. The problem with her ideology is it is fantasy because it doesn't take into account the human condition, and the human condition is greed. And once you mix greed in with all these industrialists, they lose. They lose sight of the fact that there's something else happening tomorrow other than just profit today. And what happens is they don't take care of the Alaska area. They don't care about it. They just care about pulling the oil out. Even though they probably could do it in a manner that would be environmentally sound, they don't care. They're too greedy. They don't read Ayn Rand the right way.
Did you read Atlas Shrugged, really?
I read Atlas Shrugged. And what I read, what is that? Those people that ran those businesses were benevolent businessmen. They were not thieves. And what we have today is thieves. You take the thieves out of the picture.
Did you read chapter 2?
Well, here, Mitch, Harry, is there any country in the world that you can
speak a little bit? Chapter 2, part 3 is entitled The Utopia of Greed.
Yeah, Harry, can you identify for me one country where this has worked?
The United States of America, 1776 to about 1880.
Where it was, where a corporation, during that period of time, interestingly enough, corporations did not have rights as human beings like they do now. Corporations had to, as their first article of incorporation, serve the public good before they could make a profit. And that was a time that you think was good?
It was not true. That's not true. That
corporations routinely got the death sentence. In fact, from 1830 to the Civil War, it was over 2,000 a year.
Why are we not discussing the issue of greed, which we were on a second ago? Why have we switched to corporations? I'm in favor of corporations, but why are we switching?
We have 20 seconds left, Harry. I'll give it to you. You can wrap the show.
If greed means the desire to achieve values and not to let any fear or laziness stand in the way and to enjoy values once you get them, then I'm in favor of greed. If greed means being dishonest or victimizing someone, that is wrong.
Okay. Harry Binswanger, you can learn all about it at Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Harry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. And we're going to be picking up here at the top of the next hour, right after the news. Jeffrey Feldman, the editor-in-chief of Frame Shop is Open, will be with us. And then in the hour following that, Larry Scott, founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, of course, will be taking your calls and just a whole pile of interesting stuff in the news today, including Bush's new new domestic policy advisor. That's a strange idea about how journalists should be killed. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of FrameShopIsOpen.com. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hey, Tom.
Great to have you with us. Proving a negative, your frame for the day. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, just recently, in listening to the Bush administration talk about their attempts to establish diplomatic relations with Iran, I noticed that both Condoleezza Rice and President Bush are using a rhetorical tactic that they used in the days of brinksmanship leading up to the war with Iraq. And it is, very simply, they're asking Iran to prove that they don't have something before they will establish diplomatic ties with them. In this case, it's a conversation with Iran, and Condoleezza Rice in a statement today said that Iran has to prove that they've stopped their nuclear program. And I think that in that case she's referring to both nuclear energy and research on nuclear weapons. This is precisely the same type of framing that unfolded with Iraq. People recall before the war, the president and everyone involved in the administration was demanding that Iraq prove that they don't have any more weapons of mass destruction, that buzz phrase that was used back then.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an impossible rhetorical, it's impossible to prove a negative. You can't produce evidence of something that isn't there. And so it leads to this type of exchange where Iran will say that they've ended their nuclear weapons program and the administration will ask for more and more and more evidence. And the goal here is to up the pressure in the system so that they can come to some type of intimidating conclusion with Iran. It's really, I think, quite surprising to see this being used again.
The prove you don't have something, it goes hand in hand with the argument that the Bush administration is making that the fact that we haven't been attacked since 9/11, at least domestically in the United States, other than arguably the anthrax attack, which somehow they always conveniently forget. I think that they're talking about attacks by foreigners. The fact that we haven't been attacked since 9/11 is proof that the Bush administration policies are working.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, what I don't have in my hand is the evidence that you need to show that that what we're doing is correct. It's a very similar logic, and it just doesn't hold water because it's not possible. And this is a lesson that most students learn in high school rhetoric classes. You cannot prove the absence of something. You can only prove the presence of something. And by demanding that someone prove that something isn't there, or by using that absence, it's just a way of attempting to control the debate rather than actually arguing at a serious level.
Now, Jeffrey Feldman, I mean, you've done a good job of defining the frame that they're using and identifying that, and I think Americans need to know that to be able to counter it. In your opinion, does this mean that the Bushies are, since this is the exact same frame that they used before the war in Iraq, that they're setting up a war in Iran? Or is there some other alternative that you can conceive of?
I'm not convinced that it means that they're setting up a war in Iran, because I'm not sure that at this point that the administration is that much in control of what's going on with Iran.
Yeah.
I think that what it indicates is that they're flush out of ideas. I mean, I think of the rhetoric with the Bush administration has had a lot of leftovers that they've been pulling out of their old kind of refrigerator of speeches for a while now. I noticed it in the last State of the Union address. We're getting old speech rhetoric here, and I think that they're just reverting to an old strategy because it buys them time. But I think ultimately what they want is to get the president in a position where he looks like he's doing something. I mean, he's using a phrase, using the word diplomacy a lot in speeches. We're going to hear that over the next week, that there's a real effort to be diplomatic. So I think that they're running poll numbers, and they believe the country wants to see them in some way as being diplomatic rather than bellicose, and this is their attempt to do it.
How do we rebut or fight back against or whatever this particular frame of, see, there's, you know, either the frame to Iran of, you know, prove to us that something doesn't exist, or the odd inverse of that, the fact that we haven't been hit is proof that, you know, there's something that doesn't exist, the lack of attacks, is proof that something does exist. That is a Bush foreign policy that's successful.
That's a really good question, and it's hard to come up with an easy answer to it. But my what I'm talking about on Frameshop is this idea of smart security. The notion that in response to these types of propositions, you know, in the case of the Bush administration saying we're not going to allow Iran to sit down with us until they've proven this, I think that one way to frame this from the progressive Democratic perspective is to say, is that smart? Is that the best way to go about things? Isn't it much smarter to have an ongoing conversation rather than to put up some type of hurdle for a conversation, to question back the administration on this terms of smart security. But that's one approach, although it's not the only one. I think that the Democrats are going to be talking through a bunch of possibilities.
Okay, some of the other frames that you're talking about over at Frameshop is open. Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief there. Three ways progressives can say it better?
Yeah, three ways progressives can say it better, built on the idea that I just talked about there. I think that in this moment, with this crisis or diplomatic moment with Iran, it's time really for Democrats to retrench and take charge of national security, the debate there. And again, it's talking about smart security, talking in about inspired service in the country, and talking about American leadership. These three ideas are the ways that Democrats can move beyond simply staying inside the war on terror frame. It's really important, particularly moving into 2006 and 2008. The Democrats have an alternative to this idea of the war on terror. They're going to keep on getting hit with notions that they're easy on the war on terror, that they want to pull back out of Iraq, and they have to have their own vision. And I think these three areas in particular are incredibly important.
Amnesia in America, Jeffrey Feldman.
Amnesia in America is a piece that I wrote about the Enron case. Well, we all heard that Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling were convicted on multiple counts of fraud in this Enron case, which took years and years to resolve. But it made a very little splash, I felt, in the media. And in particular, this idea that the defense that the Enron people used, this notion that they didn't know, they were unaware of what was going on in their own company, is remarkably similar to the rhetoric that the administration used in defense of the crimes that they have allegedly been committing. And so I wrote this piece about an epidemic of people in positions of power saying that they don't know, they forgot when presented with wrongdoing, and that's something that needs to be confronted at a very high level. We need to stop allowing our leaders to say that they forgot and start talking about responsibility.
And you also are blogging over at frameshopisopen.com about how the Swift boaters are the equivalent of gangs in a moral America.
Exactly. I mean, John Kerry, I reposted that piece, which is from last year, because John Kerry, there was just a piece in the Times about him retrenching his effort to disprove the Swift Boat campaigns against him. He produced some photographs which show evidence of him having been wounded in these incidents that the Swift Boaters claim did not happen. And I commend John Kerry for that effort, but I wanted to simply reassert the notion that the facts alone are not enough to battle these types of smear campaigns. What's important is what I call a reframing of the entire idea of elections. I use the word gangs to describe the Swift Boat folks because they really do are using a tactic of intimidation in order to prevent people from speaking out in a fair electoral process. And so I think that the Democrats need to go beyond facts, and they need to appoint someone who would be in charge, a face who is in charge of reminding the public that when there are Swift Boat style attacks, that is an assault on the entire system, not just on one candidate.
And yet it's happening right now with Al Gore.
It's happening again with Al Gore. It'll happen with every candidate that takes the lead. I mean, we all are should prepare. It's going to happen with Hillary Clinton. It's remarkable the extent to which we have allowed these groups to function by not seeing the bigger picture. I think it's really important when these when they stand up and do use these tactics that there is a recognizable face, someone who is able to say, look, this is not just an attack on one candidate. This is something that weakens our entire system because it intimidates people from participating.
Yeah. We're talking with Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief at Frameshop is open. Jeffrey, we have a minute and a half or so here, and in that time, I'm wondering if you can give us a snapshot of the frames you're seeing coming down right now from the RNC and what the Democratic response should be. What's on the horizon?
Well, I think we're going to see more Iran, first of all, we talked about in the beginning of the segment. We're going to see more and more the attempt of the president to be cast as a real diplomat, and Democrats can respond by using that smart security frame. Also, the Secretary of the Treasury has been changed. I'm afraid that the name of the person has eluded me at the moment. But
Paulson.
That's right, a former head of Goldman Sachs. And they are going, the Republicans are going to try to frame this person as someone who supports the president's policies. But in fact, this is someone who's been extremely outspoken on environmental issues. This is an opportunity for the Democrats to really step in and talk about how important it is to have someone in that position.
Well, the Republicans are now talking about how this proves that George W. Bush likes dissent in his cabinet.
George W. Bush, that we all know, does not reward dissent. George, he rewards absolute loyalty.
Right. I think this is an indication of how desperate he is to get somebody into the cabinet who has some credibility with regard to the economy.
Yeah, he's definitely desperate.
Because this economy is in big trouble because of his policies. Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief, frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
After the break, the latest news from Iraq as lives hang in the balance. And your calls at 1-800-448-866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Me over and I guess she thought I was all right. All right in a sort of a limited way for an off night. She said, don't I know you from the cinematographer's party? I said, who am I to blow against the wind?
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least a clean election. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Time to look at what's up in Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the camp. And there is blood on the wire.
The following, security and other developments in Iraq. On Wednesday, as of 9:30 Greenwich Mean Time, this from Reuters. Mogdadia, the mayor of Mogdadia, was killed along with his brother and his cousin when a bomb planted in his office exploded. In Mosul, a car bomb exploded, wounding 20 people, including 5 policemen in the northern city of Mosul. Near Baghdad, Iraqi police found the bodies of 4 people with bullet wounds in their bodies. In Kirkuk, Iraq police found a corpse bearing signs of torture with gunshot wounds in his head. In Baghdad, gunmen killed Ali Jafar, sports anchor man for Iraqi state television, as he left his home. In Samawa, a civilian was wounded when a roadside bomb went off near a military patrol in the southern city of Samawa. In Kirkuk, Iraqi police arrested an insurgent in Kirkuk. In Baghdad, 42 bodies have been found dumped over the last 24 hours in various parts of Baghdad, many of them shot, bound, and showing signs of torture. In Khalidia, an Iraqi soldier was killed and four others were wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their patrol. In Baghdad, two policemen were seriously wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their patrol in Baghdad. In Tikrit, gunmen killed two police officers in two different incidents. In Tikrit, in Kirkuk, gunmen killed a civilian and wounded two others on Tuesday night outside a mobile shop in Kirkuk. And the trial of Saddam Hussein and seven co-accused for crimes against humanity is due to resume today in Baghdad. This 1 year since Dick Cheney said the insurgency was in its last throes. And, of course, 3 years. We have been in Iraq almost as long as we fought World War II. Of course, that was a war that Democrats were fighting. We won. This is a war Republicans are fighting. Yeah, it's going to go the same way Vietnam did with Nixon, I'm telling you. 1-866-440-8466. Steve in Albany, New York. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today? Steve? He's on. Okay, we'll put Steve on hold, and we will come back to him. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia. Patricia? We'll come back to you. You have to listen to your phones, folks. Karen in Federal Way, Washington.
Hey, Tom. Thanks.
Hey, Karen.
I just wanted to drop in a couple of items from South Dakota. I was born there and have a great interest in the state. In regard to H.R. 1215, which was pretty a ban on abortion, essentially.
Right.
Over 38,000 signatures were delivered, I think, as of today.
Yes, this morning in South Dakota. That's twice. Actually, it was yesterday afternoon. And that's twice the number that is needed to get on the ballot.
Right. So it should be unless there's a countersuit. Now, another item.
Just for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about, Karen, South Dakota has banned the legislature, the Republican-controlled legislature of South Dakota, in defiance of public opinion polls, by the way, I would add, has banned abortion in South Dakota. And so the public got together and they said, okay, we're going to put this to the public for a vote, and they're going to put it on the ballot in November. And it may or may not end up on the ballot, as you point out, but they got twice the number of signatures necessary, apparently without a lot of effort, to put this thing on the ballot.
Yeah, one other item. I don't know if you've heard of Cecilia Fire Thunder of the Oglala tribe.
Mm-hmm.
She proposed putting an abortion clinic on the Oglala Nation lands.
Yes, that was a few months ago.
Right. At any rate, there's been a coup d'etat within the tribe, and she appears to have been ousted. The council is saying because she received funds from outsiders for the clinic.
Interesting.
Don't know. I can't get any information. I don't know whether she really is out, whether the charges are true, and what's going to happen.
Yeah, but for our listeners who aren't familiar with the situation, what she was suggesting was because the Sioux Nation is an independent nation and the tribe operates independent to a large extent of federal law and certainly of state law, not so much of federal law, but certainly of state law, and there is no federal law banning abortion, just a state law in South Dakota, that they would be able to establish an abortion clinic on the tribe's federal lands, much like a casino being exempt from state rules against gambling, and that would then be a potential source of revenue for the tribe. It would also be a community service for the state. And interesting that she's been bounced. The internal politics in a lot of these Native American tribes around the country are getting very convoluted these days, particularly when you throw money into the mix and you throw political forces and factions. Karen, thanks for the update.
You're welcome. Bye.
Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. I have to tell you, what's up with Joe Lieberman, and what does that tell us about America? Right after the break. We'll be back after the news at the bottom of the hour. 27 minutes past the hour. Mm-hmm.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Tuesday in November, I took that stroll to cast my ballot at the local poll. The lines were long, but I didn't care. I had water, a hat, and my folding chair. Walked up to the booth, didn't say a word. Sure that my voice would be heard. I hit that button, my vote was sent. But now nobody knows exactly where it went. I lost my vote. It isn't fair. I took a stand. Doesn't anybody care? Then I lost my vote. Now do you know where did my ballot go?
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Now, let me get this right. Saddam Hussein is going on trial, is on trial right now in Iraq for what he, as the way that Saddam Hussein described himself, the leader with the iron fist, right? One of his many nicknames. Saddam Hussein, Iron Fist. Well, the headline, if you go to nytimes.com, there's a photo of Prime Minister Nouri Kamal al-Maliki, the new Prime Minister of Iraq, and the caption, the headline on the photo. The caption says, in Basra, Iraqi leader promises an, quote, iron fist, end quote. Meet the new management, same as the old management. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. One of the folks in the chat room pointed out George W. Bush had said to the Mennonites, I believe, that God was talking to him, and the reason why was because they were the only folks. The Amish. Here we go. President Bush spoke with the Amish. He didn't want to, but it was the only group he could find that wasn't upset about the high price of gas. So yeah, it's a good one. All right, I promised you, Joe Lieberman. This is really a big deal, and David Sirota has, as always and so often, just really nailed this down so well. His latest column, you can find over at davidsirota.com, and what he's pointing out and doing a really good job of it is that Joe Lieberman is the poster boy for the way that the right wing has hijacked the media and public discourse in the United States. Whenever you see Joe Lieberman being described on TV or in the Washington Post or in the New York Times, any of the main media in the United States, Joe Lieberman is always referred to as the centrist Democrat. He's never referred to as the right-wing fringe Democrat. He's always described as the centrist Democrat, or very often they'll use the word mainstream. Joe Lieberman, the mainstream candidate for the Senate, Democrat Joe Lieberman trying to hold on to his seat from radical left Ned Lamont, right? That kind of thing. And David Sirota says, this is no accident. He says, this is a deliberate strategy employed by big money interests that run the establishment to effectively marginalize the vast majority of the American population from our own political debate. Now, you get this. This is separating us from our own discussion of politics. For example, Marshall Whitman. This is the guy who told the L.A. Times that the Connecticut primary, this is Lieberman versus Lamont. Joe Lieberman is now has a primary challenger, Ned Lamont. That this is a battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. Now, you'll recall my having been saying that for the better part of 3 years now, that there is a battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party between the old-fashioned liberal Democrats and the newfangled DLC Republican light Democrats, brought to you courtesy of Bill Clinton and Evan Bayh and Joe Lieberman and that crowd. And he goes on to say, this is Marshall Whitman. He goes on to say, this race, this Lieberman race, will have repercussions for the 2008 presidential campaign and whether centrists will feel comfortable within the Democratic Party. Well, it turns out Whitman is not only a shill for Lieberman, he's also not, currently he's employed by the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC. This is the right-wing fringe within the Democratic Party that says that they speak for Democrats. But before that, he was an official with the ultra-right-wing Christian Coalition, Jerry Falwell's organization. But he's right, as Sirota points out, that there is a battle for the, you know, a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. But who are the real centrists? You know, for a long time I referred to this program as uncommon sense in the radical middle. I don't use the phrase radical middle quite so much any longer because I think it's important for us for two reasons. One, other people are starting to use it a lot. And secondly, I think it's really important for us to reclaim the terms liberal and progressive. Although I'll still use it because I believe, I really, and I can prove it, and I'm going to right now, that the positions that I take on this program, the positions that most of my listeners, if our calls and you know, email went out, feedback over at the message board went, most of our listeners agree with, are actually representative of mainstream America. We are the centrists. You and I, we are the middle of the road folks. We are the, now I realize, you know, there's the old saying, you say, what? We're the middle of the road, what? Wasn't it Jim Hightower who said the only thing in the middle of the road are yellow lines and dead armadillos? Yeah, I think so. But looking at, yeah, I mean, just look at the curve. For example, the Iraq War. Joe Lieberman, the so-called centrist. He says that you shouldn't criticize the Iraq War because it undermines the president's credibility at our nation's peril. He also said because of the Iraq War, quote, the world is safer, America is safer, end quote. Well, the fact of the matter is that's not a centrist position. That's the extreme right-wing position. The majority of Americans. Most recently, in a CNN USA Today poll, showed that the majority of Americans believe that the Iraq War has made America less safe. Two-thirds of Americans oppose the war and want a change in policy. Two-thirds! Which means that the position that Lieberman is taking, that you shouldn't even criticize Bush, and that the world is safer because of the war, is agreed to by fewer than a third of Americans, and is therefore the out-of-the-mainstream position. Let's take Social Security. Back in 2000, the New York Times reporting Joe Lieberman, as David Sirota points out, publicly suggesting, quote, that he could support allowing workers to invest a portion of their payroll taxes in the private markets, end quote. Joe Lieberman, as far back 6 years ago, promoting the partial privatization of Social Security. Is that a mainstream position? No. According to a CNN USA Today poll, 59% of Americans are opposed to any kind of privatization whatsoever of Social Security. Two-thirds. An NBC News poll, 55% of the public opposed the concept. So somewhere between more than half and less than two-thirds of Americans believe that Social Security should not be privatized at all in any way, period. Don't go near it. And that is the mainstream position. That's the middle. That's the radical middle. That is the centrist position because it's the position held by the majority of Americans. Joe Lieberman clearly is outside that. He is the extremist. On health care, I mean, this is amazing. On health care, anybody who goes out and says, well, there's 37 fully industrialized countries and advanced democracies in the world, and 36 of them have national health care programs. Only the United States doesn't. We should have a national health care program, too. Anybody who says that is labeled by the mainstream media, which has interlocking boards of directors, these big, giant corporate media, interlocking boards of directors with big health insurance companies and HMOs, and you can see it all over at theyrule.net. Whenever any politician says that we should have national health care, they're labeled as a fringe candidate or an extreme liberal candidate. Well, what is the fringe on this issue? 67% of Americans, 67% of Americans believe that government should guarantee health insurance to all citizens, even if that means repealing Bush's tax cuts. Only 26% of Americans don't agree with that statement. So Lieberman is not the centrist. Lieberman's point of view represents less than a quarter of Americans. 67% of Americans are in favor of a national tax health care system, even if it means increasing taxes. Quoting David Sirota in January 2004, this is a Greenberg, Quinlan, Rosner public opinion strategy poll. They found in January 2004, 69% to 28% majority saying that they would be willing to pay more per year in federal taxes to assure every American citizen received health care coverage. So we're the majority. We're the centrists. And yet they say, you guys, you're the radicals. No, I'm sorry. Two-thirds of Americans say that they're in favor of national health care. And that position is when it's in the mainstream. And Joe Lieberman is opposed to that. Ned Lamont's in favor of it, by the way. See, what's happening is you've got radical Joe Lieberman, right-wing radical, running against a true centrist, Ned Lamont. It shows up on a whole bunch of other issues, too. I'll go through a few of them right after the break. Plus, we're going to have Talk Radio News with an update from Washington, D.C., 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. A place where reason is our lifestyle choice for the day. Joe Lieberman on prescription drugs. He was opposed to price controls on drugs in the year 2000, told that to the Washington Post. Although he had received $400,000 in drug money cash, that might have influenced his opinion. Nonetheless, the majority of Americans support drug price controls. A 2004 Harris poll, 60% favor federal government price controls. Further, two-thirds, 66% of Americans, say there should be more government regulation of prescription drug prices, and 70%, almost three-quarters of Americans, say if the federal government does the research that leads to the development of new drugs, which is the case in over 90% of all drugs, then the federal government should be able to regulate the price of those drugs. Lieberman's position representing less than 20% of Americans, and yet his position is considered mainstream. The position held by the majority of Americans, that's characterized as an extremist or a left-wing or a liberal position in the media. I mean, do you get how strange all this is? Trade deals, NAFTA, WTO, China, PNTR, all of these positions, anybody who attacks them, they're called a protectionist. Oh, my God, it's a protectionist. And Lieberman is a courageous centrist. But he doesn't represent the center. He doesn't represent the position of most Americans. In 2005, a July poll in 2005 found that 56% of Americans said they are, quote, not satisfied with the way the U.S. government is dealing with the effects of trade on American jobs, the poor, and other countries and the environment. 90% of Americans want trade deals to be amended to include strong labor protections, including domestic labor. 93% of Americans want trade deals to have strong environmental protections. Lieberman opposes both and is referred to by the Washington Post as a centrist for it. And yet only 7% of Americans hold the position that he holds. In March of 2003, Epic MRA poll found just 21%, quoting David Sirota here, found just 21% of Americans said they wanted to, quote, continue the NAFTA agreement, end quote, quote. Fewer than one in five Americans want us to continue the NAFTA agreement, and yet that is considered the mainstream position, the centrist position by our crazed, out-of-control right-wing media in the United States, like the Washington Post, the New York Times, CBS, ABC, NBC, MSNBC, and so on. 61% of Americans, this is a poll done by the Christian Science Monitor and Investors Business Daily, 61% of Americans think, quote, think U.S. trade policy should have restrictions on imported foreign goods to protect American jobs, end quote. The position I've been taking on this program for 3 years. Only 24% of Americans say they wanted to continue the NAFTA agreement. This is another separate poll. And the list goes on and on. Lieberman supporting larger Pentagon budgets. Yet national polls show that the majority of Americans, the vast majority, between 55 and 75%, depending on which poll you look at, support deep cuts in defense spending, a significant reallocation toward deficit reduction, and increases in spending on education, job training, reducing reliance on oil, and veterans, end quote. When he brags about co-sponsoring a tax cut for the wealthy, capital gains tax cut, in 1997, fewer than 10% of Americans thought that should be a priority of Congress. And yet he's called a centrist for this. I'm sorry. He is not. And, Jeff, you disagree with me. Jeff in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jeff.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with you on all that, Tom, but the one thing that I do believe that the majority of Americans want is the illegal aliens deported and a fence that's 1,962 miles long built on our border with Mexico.
I believe that the majority of Americans don't want to be losing their jobs to illegal aliens, and this has been framed in the media to say if you don't want your job lost to an illegal alien, the only way to have that happen is to give Halliburton and Bechtel billions, hundreds of billions of dollars to build a giant fence, and to hire Blackwater Security to deport a bunch of illegal aliens. And the fact of the matter is, if instead we said, sorry, those big Republican and Democratic Party campaign contributors, the corporations, are going to start, you know, their leaders are going to start going to jail if they hire illegals. If you made it illegal to hire illegals, or if you actually enforced the laws against it, it's already illegal, and started putting people in jail for it, you would have something called attrition. People would leave on their own.
I believe in that. I agree with that.
Yeah, so how come you told our call screener you disagree with me?
Well,
is that just to get to the front of the line? Come on, Jeff.
Well, Tom, I think the real problem is, isn't it that the birth rate is out of control in Mexico? There's more Mexicans than there are jobs in Mexico. And because of that...
That's always been the case.
They can pay very low wages.
That has always been the case. Jeff, 50 years ago, half of Mexico lived on less than $2 a day in today's money. Right now, 50% of Mexico lives on less than $2 a day in today's money.
Well, then,
the poverty rate as a percentage in Mexico has not changed. But 50 years ago, illegal aliens could not find employment in the United States. And ever since, largely since Reagan's amnesty in 86, we have not been enforcing laws against hiring illegals. And as a consequence, they're flowing into this country. By the way, I got an email from somebody the other day who said, oh, you shouldn't refer to people as illegal. There's no such thing as illegal humans. You know, one of the frames that what's-his-name is talking about. Okay, fine. Instead of referring to them as illegals, I should call them criminals. Because people who committed crimes are criminals.
But don't we need to get this oligarchy in Mexico stopped?
Yeah, I agree. And the best way to stop it is not us. It's not the United States going in. And, Jeff, thank you for the call. The way to stop the oligarchy in Mexico is to deny them the safety valve of sending their surplus folks to the United States. If 20 million Mexicans were not able to leave Mexico, they would be on the streets in Mexico City demanding political change. And instead, Mexico is fixing to elect a right-wing candidate because he's the guy who's going to say, oh, yeah, we're going to continue this open border policy with the United States, and we're going to stand up to the United States and all this. No, I'm sorry. It is. We are doing Mexico a terrible disservice by providing them that safety valve. 57 minutes past.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. In the Darwinian world of ideas, we're at the top of the food chain here on the Tom Hartman radio program. And Victoria Jones, our senior food chain correspondent from Washington, D.C., with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. I'm climbing the food chain. I'm hoping to get as far up it as you. I don't know. I'm in the belly of the beast in the basement of the White House right now.
And a fine place it is, no
yes,
doubt.
Yes, indeed,
so,
it so is.
How is the White House dealing with the, you know, Think Progress having exposed this riff that Bush's Carl Zinnmeister, his new domestic policy advisor, went off on a couple of years ago, where he said, alas, many of the journalists observable in this Iraq war theater are bursting with knee-jerk suspicions and antagonisms for the warriors all around them. A significant number are whining, appallingly soft. I almost wish there would be a very loud explosion very nearby just to shut up their rattling. And now we have 71 journalists who are dead, the same number as during Vietnam.
Yes, well, he basically said, and when Helen Thomas raised this yesterday, that that you know, he himself had said critical things in the past of people who he now worked for, and you know, you adapt and you move on, and it was one sentence, and sort of that was that.
And you think that's going to be that?
I think that's going to be that. I can tell you that it didn't come up today. Now, fair enough, today there was big Iran news, and I brought up, and some others brought up Haditha, but it didn't come up today, so I think that may be that, unless Helen chooses to go back to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. So what you brought up in the Iran news, what's hot today?
Well, I mean, the mainstream media is very interested in the possible talks with Iran. I'm not, because they're not going to happen.
Mm. You think this is posturing on the part of the Bush administration?
Well, I think it may be an effort. I mean, I'm sure that we would like to have talks with Iran, because, you know, it would do everybody good to have talks with Iran. We could certainly do them some good, and it wouldn't do us any harm either. But, you know, requiring them to stop their naughty practices ahead of time, well, they won't even acknowledge that they're doing anything that's naughty, so they're not going to stop it.
Right. It would require them to acknowledge something that they claim they are not doing, which
exactly.
is building weapons.
So it ain't going to happen anytime soon.
So the Bush administration essentially just set up something that's guaranteed to fail, knowing that it was guaranteed to fail, so that they could claim, see, we're not the bad guys, they are.
I think that there's truth to that. And in the meantime, Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, has headed off to Vienna for talks.
With whom about what?
With the EU3, I believe, about Iran, I believe. God, I hope I'm not wrong. I don't know the details of that, but yeah. I believe that's what she's doing.
So.
But, you know, people are very intrigued with the idea that Iran may, in fact, do something on this. I just am cynical where that particular country is concerned and do not believe that anything's going to change anytime soon.
Yeah. And you said another topic came up in the
podcast. Well, the Haditha massacre came up.
Oh, yeah.
I had asked yesterday about President Bush's briefing on this and when he knew and what he knew, and Stephen Hadley briefed him on this after the Time magazine journalist contacted the White House, and I wanted to know whether, in fact, he was briefed as a result of that or whether he was briefed routinely, you know, and I didn't get an answer to that today, but I'm assured that there is a timeline that Tony has, and he asked me to call him later today. He'll let me have it, because I then wanted to know, when did Donald Rumsfeld first know about this, and when did Donald Rumsfeld first talk to the president about Haditha?
Yeah, and speaking of Haditha, just a couple of quick clips here. This is Jack Murtha on Good Morning America discussing this.
There's no charges yet filed against any of the Marines that were in this outfit, but Jonathan mentioned a moment ago defense lawyers are already saying, well, there's drone video and there is actual radio traffic to higher-ups that will give a different picture than you have been talking about of this incident. What do you know about that?
I can only tell you this. I can only tell you this, Charles. This is what the Marine Corps told me at the highest level. The Commandant of the Marine Corps was in my office just last week. So you know, I know there was a cover-up someplace. They knew about this a few days afterwards, and there's no question the chain of command tried to stifle this story. I can understand why, but that doesn't excuse it. Something like this has to be brought out to the public, and the people have to be punished.
Yeah, so that's Jack Murtha. He's a little upset about this. And then the ambassador, the new ambassador from Iraq to the United States, saying...
So what you're suggesting, your cousin was killed in cold blood, is that what you're saying,
Wolf
by
Blitzer.
United States Marines?
I believe he was killed intentionally. I believe he was killed unnecessarily.
And unfortunately, the investigations that took place after that sort of took a different course and concluded that there was no unlawful killing. I would like further investigation. I have, in fact, asked for the report of the last investigation, which was a criminal investigation, by the way.
So there now we have even the ambassador from Iraq saying that our soldiers killed his cousin.
Right. This is the ambassador who he got credentialed last week. We were very excited about this here at the White House. President Bush actually attended the credentialing ceremony, something he does not do for ambassadors because it was such an exciting thing to have an ambassador to Iraq. Now, the president has said that he is troubled by, you know, all this story and that if people are found to have committed crimes, they will be punished. I also asked today whether, you know, in view of the fact that there have been serious allegations of foot dragging at the very least and cover up perhaps at the most, maybe it was time to get ahead of the curve, go on the offense, and just appoint an independent commission.
And the response you got?
The response was that we should let the Marines do their job, do the investigation. They're doing, you know, a very serious investigation. It's a criminal investigation, and we shouldn't prejudge.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling, you know, Jack Murtha, being a Marine himself for 37 years, he's putting some pressure on them. And if the commandant of the Marine Corps was in his office telling him that there'd been a cover-up last week, then I think you could take that to the bank.
It's quite an extraordinary story.
Yeah,
it is. And it gets more extraordinary every day.
Yeah. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for being with us. Thanks
for the
report today. Great talking with you. It's 12 minutes past the hour. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi. Your talk about the press's treatment of Lieberman really brings up, like, the whole the myth that we live with every day, the way that we get labeled and the way we don't adopt our own language. Just this morning, NPR, who is labeled as liberal, did a love letter to Goldman Sachs and Paulson, ignoring the fraud and excessive compensation that they've had, you know, excessive CEO compensation.
Yeah, Paulson, a guy who's worth $500 million, replacing Jon Snow, a guy only worth $125 million.
Yeah, and the so-called liberal NPR talked about the public service of all the that is such a the heart of Goldman Sachs.
That.
It was just, I mean, everybody should listen to this on Morning Edition Day. It was really bizarre.
Yeah.
But anyway, the whole thing of labels, most of us, I'd say, are outside of the two political parties. There's no room in the center for anyone to fit, actually. The two parties are so much alike.
Yeah.
And if you, this whole
well, yes and no. I mean, that's my point about the battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. And you're part of that, Jeff. I mean, you're participating in Democratic Party politics in Colorado as part
yes.
of the attempt to take back the party.
And to make a note of how different the party is than what is, you know, we see out there, the party, I just helped, it was a major factor in writing the platform for the state.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things, we had overwhelming support, and I can't emphasize enough, support for impeachment and for censure, you know, for investigation, impeachment, censure and impeachment.
Right.
For Bush and Cheney.
And I suspect
not one of the party leaders mentioned that in any of their speeches.
See, and that's such a mistake because, and this is where I think that the Republicans are shooting themselves in the foot. I mean, I am constantly getting this stuff, an email from the Republicans going, oh, the Democrats are in favor of impeachment. They're the party of impeachment. And I suspect that a lot of the people that they're sending this stuff to are going, yep, we're all in favor of impeachment.
Yeah, so the party is, if going from the caucus level to the county assemblies to the state convention and everything, the people are much more radical than the politicians, you know, would appear.
Yeah.
It's a dramatically more radical party.
Yeah.
And I think many of the membership, you know, who are frustrated went to the Greens, but you know, there are a lot of people who really and the Democrats are much more of a Green Party platform than of what the Democratic elected officials would appear to be.
Yeah.
But anyway, the main thing was this thing about the language, though. That this whole thing, we've adopted this myth of there are two sides to every argument. Mm-hmm. And that there's left and right and so forth. We're all over the place in a sphere of different perspectives. And it's not, you know, that we've accepted this two sides every argument thing has just really hurt us.
But that's my point, is that if you're trying to define the center, if you're trying to define what that sphere is, the
mm-hmm.
vast majority of Americans are taking positions that are being labeled by the mainstream media as being extremist.
Yeah. There's an interesting
or as being liberal.
There's an interesting tool on the web called politicalcompass.org. That at least goes to two-dimensional rather than one-dimensional.
Yeah.
You can take a test to see where you fit in that.
Yeah. There's another interesting one over at theyrule.net. If you can get connections between companies. If, for example, you plug in Viacom and Halliburton, you find that Viacom has on its board William Gray, who's on the board of Pfizer, which also has on its board William Howell, who's on the board of Halliburton.
Yeah.
General Electric, which owns NBC, has Ralph S. Larson on its board, who's also on the board of AT&T, along with Donald Fites, who's on the board of Halliburton. It just goes on and on and on. It's like you can connect any of the big major media companies to Halliburton.
Yep.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Lines are running to and fro, hard working at the mill, never fail in the mail, yet come a lot too long. Too much monkey business, too much monkey business, too much monkey business for me to get involved in.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. Larry Scott, the editor-in-chief, Big Cheese, top dog, general, all about guy at vawatchdog.org. Hey, Larry.
Hello, Tom. I should give myself a raise after that introduction.
I know. Well, we've got to come up with a title for you that's just like, you know, really, really and truly astounding. Vawatchdog.org, by the way, one of the top veterans websites in the universe, and at least in the known universe. You can easily access it at vawatchdog.org. Larry, what's up with what's the latest news on the theft of veterans' data?
Well, it is really interesting because if you recall a week ago when you and I spoke, I was questioning the VA story about the stolen data. They had originally said they had 25.6 million or 26.5 million veterans, rather, and they had name, date of birth, and Social Security number, which that's important when it comes to identity matters. But I had questioned, well, what data is there to analyze in a database like that? There's nothing there to analyze, and there had to be more information, such as, well, perhaps addresses or medical information.
Right, because this guy was an analyst, and he was taking it home to work on.
Right, he was taking all this information home. In the last 2 hours, Hope Yen of the Associated Press, marvelous reporter, by the way, who's really dug into this, guess what was in the database? Names, addresses, phone numbers, dates of birth, Social Security numbers, and also disability codes or diagnostic codes for many of the veterans. The VA has just shot themselves in the foot with this, Tom, leaking this a little bit at a time instead of just coming up. So what's happened now in the veteran community just in the last couple of hours? I've been swamped with emails. There's no credibility here now. Yeah. We're getting this piecemeal, just a little here and a little there. And in their credibility, just shot on this matter.
Well, Jim Nicholson, the VA secretary, I mean, what qualifications did he have to be secretary of the Veterans Administration other than the fact that he was a political hack for Bush, for the Republicans?
He had the same qualifications that you or I had, basically none. He was head of the RNC, and he had also been ambassador to the Vatican. He had no experience in the healthcare area. He was not known as a veterans advocate in any way.
In the Republican world, being the head of the Republican National Committee qualifies you for a lot. I mean, that got George Bush Sr. into the head of the CIA and vice president and then president of the United States.
Quite frankly, that made Nicholson one of the most powerful people in the United States of America, and no one questions that. Politically, he's an extremely powerful man. As far as his ability to run the VA, he's been pretty much hands-off. You know, he's given this to the political appointees under him.
Well, doesn't he have some sort of an economic connection with the VA as well?
Isn't
there a company that he's associated with?
No,
oh, that was Principi.
Anthony Principi, the previous secretary of the VA, had some business associations with the VA.
And still does.
And still does. But what we've got going now is, now that we found out there are addresses involved here for many of the veterans, phone numbers, and we have a VA body count now that stands at about 2.5, the data analyst, who is a GS-14, which is a very high-paying position, has been or will be fired. Some of the reports are a little iffy there, but Friday would be the last day. Michael McClendon, who is a deputy assistant secretary, has resigned. That's a political position. And he was in the loop on this. He knew that this information was being taken home. We don't have to cry for Michael McClendon. He owns his own consulting firm and is a very well-heeled and also very well connected Republican, so he'll do just fine. And then we have another person in the chain of command here who was by the name of Duffy. He was an acting assistant secretary. I love these. You know, I'm trying to get the titles right, but the titles just don't make sense.
Acting assistant secretary.
Acting assistant
like the
secretary.
The part-time guy who empties the wastebasket.
But the problem with Dennis Duffy is he is a career track VA employee. So what they've had to do there is place him on administrative leave while they go through the paperwork shuffle to find out will he be fired, should he resign, and so forth.
Because he's civil service.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
and a lot different.
So do you think that McClendon and Duffy and this GS-14 analyst, that these three are going to satisfy the bloodlust over at the VA and they're going to provide political cover for good old Mr. Nicholson?
Secretary Nicholson? Yeah, I think so. They're going to provide the cover that he needs. He'll be able to stand up and say that we have taken care of this because everyone who is in the loop who knew this data analyst was removing information and taking it home to work with it has been relieved of their duties one way or another. They've either been fired or they resigned. But this is not going to satisfy the bloodlust of the American veteran.
Right. Now, I'm curious.
Go ahead.
Well, we just have a few seconds left. I'm curious, Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, Steve Boyer, the Republican from Indiana, he's the chairman of the House Veterans Committee, and Larry Craig, Republican from Idaho, is the chairman of the Senate VA Committee. Either one of these guys speaking up on this?
Oh, yes. They've both been all over this. This is terrible. This is a shame. We've got to get to the bottom of this. We'll correct it. It'll never happen again. In an election year, what else could they say, obviously?
But are they doing anything?
No, not really, other than holding hearings. What has to be done? It has to be done internally at the VA. We do have our first class action lawsuit filed in federal court in Ohio by Paul Hackett. That name should sound familiar.
Oh, yeah.
Class action lawsuit filed on behalf of all 26.5 million veterans. He's seeking approximately $1,000 per vet, and it says the VA should take care of all the credit problems.
That's pretty impressive. Well, good on Paul Hackett. He's been on this program a couple of times. We'll have to get him back on to talk about that.
You bet.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. Check it out. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great speaking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Nah.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Anyone can hack the files and push delete. There'd be no proof, and I got no receipt. Let's get the system under control, and the final results will match the exit polls. They lost my purse. It isn't fair. I took the stand. Does it anybody care? They lost my purse. Now do you know where did my ballot go? Whoa.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here in the real free speech zone. Our number 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM. And Jake in Arcata, California on the line. Hey, Jake, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great. Just great. But I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I'd like to discuss Joe Lieberman with you. You know, it's really interesting that you would mention Jim Hightower's famous metaphor, the dead armadillo in the middle of the road.
Right.
It looks like Lieberman may be that dead armadillo in the middle of the road here in this primary they have in Connecticut. Ned Lamont looks like he might do it.
Yeah.
And apparently the word is that Lieberman, if he loses the Democratic primary for the Senate, is going to run as an independent. And frankly, Lieberman should have been running as an independent or as a Republican all along. The guy's a right-wing closet Republican who's a Democrat name only.
Yeah,
and,
Zell Miller.
Exactly, or Ben Nelson.
Yeah.
And I do remember in December 2000, the day that the Republican majority of the Supreme Court appointed Bush to become president, I remember at the very moment Lieberman was being interviewed, I think, on ABC, and they cut to him after the news of the Supreme Court decision, and it was Lieberman, actually, who decided to give it up before Gore and publicly stated that, well, it's probably time to give it up. Yeah, no, I mean, seriously, I remember that, and I was irate, you know, just watching the vice presidential candidate concede before the presidential candidate did. And the whole point is Lieberman, he's a disgrace. He's supported this Iraq war no matter how ridiculously bad it has become. I mean, I'll look at Hadifa. You know, it's interesting that Bush says he didn't know about Hadifa until he was told by the media. I mean, isn't he the president? Isn't he the commander-in-chief? What the
no.
hell is Bush doing? I mean, I don't understand why the Democrats, and thanks to people like Lieberman, of course, and the party has shied away from talking about impeachment, but off-year congressional elections are always about getting the base out to vote. And if we don't give Democrats what they want, which is talk of impeachment, we're going to have a problem in November, Tom.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Jake. I absolutely agree with you. And it's why I think that the Democrats should be talking about this. And the Republicans, I think, to some extent, are doing their work for them. And I think the reason why, the only explanation that I can come up with for why the Republicans are sending out these emails to their base, to, you know, I send $5 a year into the RNC so that I'm one of their contributors, so I get all the junk, right? And I figure they send me more than $5 worth of stuff, so I'm a net loss for them, so I don't feel bad about it. Although someday, I guarantee you, someday it's going to show up. Somebody's going to say, oh, that liberal talk show host, did you know he contributes to the Republican Party? You know, so I'm telling you in advance before Drudge does. Right. But in any case, because I'm on there, I'm on that list, I'm on all these other lists, the talk show host lists, and get all the right wing news every day and all this junk. But the stuff that's coming out literally every day, the Democrats, the party of impeachment. And I think that the Republicans are beating this drum in order to intimidate the Democrats to prevent them from talking about it, because they know that if the Democrats pick this thing up and run with it, they're just going to beat the pants off Republicans all across the country in the 06 election.
Absolutely. I think that's a Rovian strategy, definitely. And I hope that the Democrats pay attention to the polls, pay attention to what Democrats want. If the Democrats want their voters to show up, we have to talk about impeachment, because Bush and Cheney are a complete disaster. And why was it okay for them to impeach Clinton over Monica Lewinsky, but we can't talk about impeachment over Katrina, Enron, the Dubai ports, the war in Iraq, 9/11, you name it. Everything that Bush has done has been a disaster. It is time to talk about impeachment. It's time to get serious about it.
Amen. Well said. And that's why, by the way, I signed on as one of the, I'm forgetting now the URL, is David Sirota's group to call for an impeachment of, or an investigation leading to the impeachment of George Bush very early on. And actually, you'll find my name on several of those websites and on those groups. Jake, thanks for the call. And thanks for listening over there on KGOE and Arcata. Good talking with you. Leon in Seattle listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Leon, what's up?
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Yeah, my point on all this discrepancy between kind of the polls and then what they call the quote-unquote mainstream is that I think people are watching less television. I think that you have, despite a lot of things, people are getting far more educated. You know, like I can go, instead of watching television, I can get a video, like network, from the public library.
Right. But...
And I think that it's making this... I think that our country is becoming more unruly because of that, because I think 60 years of television has made us a very docile group.
Yeah, it could be, but I mean, if you look at the connections, for example, I'm at theyrule.net, which is just an incredible website for this kind of stuff, and I go to I plug in Halliburton and let's say the New York Times Company, okay, LMNEW. New York. Ah, here it is. New York Times. Click that thing, click Find Path, and boom, back it comes. General Electric, which owns NBC, right, has Andrea Jung on their board of directors. Andrea Jung is on the board of Avon Products. Also on the board of Avon Products is Brenda Barnes. Brenda Barnes is on the board of New York Times. So there you have, in one skip, General Electric and New York Times have in common with them somebody who's on the board of Avon Products. And it's like the whole point of theyrule.net is there's this small group of a few hundred people who are basically on the boards of all these companies in America, and they're all interconnected. And so, you know, why would the New York Times, now that's the New York Times to General Electric, if we go to Halliburton and see what happens, because, gee, who's going to build the fence, for example? This guy called and he said, most Americans want a fence. And I said, no, most Americans just don't want to lose their job, and they think that the only option is a fence because that's all the press will talk about. Right. So, and Halliburton.
That's where the money is.
That's exactly right. Halliburton will build the fence. And so if we look at the connection between Halliburton and General Electric, which is NBC, we find that NBC, General Electric, has Ralph S. Larson on their board, who's also on the board of AT&T Wireless Services, which also has Donald Fites on its board, who's also on the board of ExxonMobil, which also has William Howell on its board, who's on the board of Halliburton. Bing, bing, bing. Three skips from GE to Halliburton. You go through Larson, Fites, and Howell, just like that. And you can, and the, all, it is impossible not to find a connection between these big media companies and, for example, Halliburton, you know, the company that's going to profit from this. Yeah, just as one example. So, anyway, it's, Leon, thanks a lot for the call.
Sure, thanks.
I appreciate the, you know, and, you know, but a point well made. Yesterday, by the way, I made the comment, some guy called, and frankly, I think that it was one of these boiler room calls. The Republicans, you know, they have people who simply call, talk radio all day long. And I could be wrong, but, you know, the guy called up and he says, well, the Democrats are just as corrupt as the Republicans. And I said, name one Democrat who took money from Jack Abramoff. It doesn't matter. Democrats are just as corrupt. I said, just name one Democrat. And he was unable to name one. So maybe he wasn't, I don't know, but I think he was unable to name one because there aren't any. So anyhow, I get this email from Glenn in Virginia. He says, Tom, you recently asked a caller to name one Democrat who received money from Jack Abramoff. Answer, Harry Reid. Well, I'm sorry. We called Harry Reid's office this morning. David Poole, my producer here, called Harry Reid's office about 4 hours ago and talked with one of the people in Harry Reid's office, said, has Harry Reid ever taken money from Jack Abramoff of any kind, in any way, at all, under any circumstances? The answer is no, not one penny. Howard Dean said it, and he was right.
There are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Not one. Not one single Democrat. Every person named in this scandal is a Republican. Every person under investigation is a Republican. Every person indicted is a Republican. This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money. And we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true. I know the Republican National Committee would like to get the Democrats involved in this. They're scared. They should be scared. They haven't told the truth. They have misled the American people. And now it appears they're stealing from Indian tribes. The Democrats are not involved in this.
Amen. Turns out that's true. That's true. What's not true is a lot of the stuff that you're seeing on the news. Andrew Buncombe in Washington reporting for The Independent, the British newspaper. The headline, Bush planted fake news stories on American TV. Yes, Bush, as in that guy who's president of the United States, or at least sits in the office of president of the United States. Federal authorities are actively investigating dozens of American television stations for broadcasting items produced by the Bush administration and major corporations, and passing them off as normal news. Some of the fake news segments talked up successes in the war in Iraq. Others promoted companies' products. This is all about the report from the Center for Media and Democracy. They looked over a 10-month period and found at least 77 TV stations making use of phony news broadcasts. Now, the Bush administration has been told by the investigative arm of Congress, they've been told, anyhow, by Congress's investigative arm that it is illegal to do what they are doing. And they continue to do it. They simply said, okay, fine, so it's illegal. We're going to continue doing it. Just like they've been told that the NSA spying program is illegal. Ah, we're going to keep on doing it. We're just going to give it a name now. It's the terrorism prevention program. No, it's illegal. Among items provided by the Bush administration to news stations was one in which an Iraqi American in Kansas City was seen saying, "Thank you, Bush. Thank you, USA." The footage was actually produced by the State Department, one of 20 federal agencies that have produced and distributed such items. Amazing. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If you knew that you would die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change? If you knew that love can't break your heart, when you're down so low, you cannot fall, would you change?
I think maybe. Welcome back. 50 minutes past the hour, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place we're tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Behind a fence topped with razor wire just off U.S. Highway 71 is a bunker of a building that Walmart considers so secret it won't even let the county assessor inside without a nondisclosure agreement. What is this? It's a 125,000-square-foot building. This is tucked behind a new Walmart supercenter, only a stone's throw away from the Arkansas line, 15 miles from corporate headquarters. Nothing to identify Walmart. There's a lot of speculation about this. Is this like, Area 51? According to one consumer activist, this, by the way, from the from Max McCoy, investigative writer for the Joplin Globe, Joplin, Missouri. This is a Missouri story here. Dateline Jane, Missouri. Walmart's ability to crunch numbers is a favorite of conspiracy theorists, and its data centers are the corporate equivalent or counterpart to Area 51. According to one consumer activist, Catherine Albrecht, even the wildest conspiracy buff might be surprised at just how much Walmart knows about its customers and how much more it would like to know. She said, we were contacted about 2 years ago by somebody who runs a security company that had been asked in a request for proposals for ways they could link video footage with customers paying for their purchases. Walmart would actually be able to view photos and videos of customers paying, say, for a pack of gum. She said, at the time, it struck me as unbelievably outlandish because of the amount of data storage required. This is interesting. So you pay for something, they get your credit card number, and they know what you bought. They, with your credit card number, they can pull up your Social Security number, your, you know, just run a credit check, your name, your address, your employer. They can get access to your medical records. See, government can't do these things. But Walmart can. Private corporations can do these things. These are all in the public marketplace. Get your insurance records. Get your doctor's records. Your psychiatrist's records, if you have one. Your podiatrist's records. You know, I mean, you, whatever you want. Ever been institutionalized? Ever had a car accident? Ever been arrested? Ever been in the military? Well, actually, the military part they might have a hard time getting unless you subscribe to a veterans publication. I think find out what magazines you subscribe to, what movies you buy. And then now they got this enormous database on you, and then they take your picture. And they merge the picture into the database, so now they have biometric data on you, too, what you look like. So now, as you walk into a Walmart, just as you walk in, you know, you think that it's just the 70-year-old greeter standing there going, "Well, hello, Sonny, nice to see you in the store today." And you think that they're doing that because, you know, studies have found that if you establish eye contact with somebody, they're less likely to shoplift, and there's probably some truth to that. But right behind that greeter might be a little camera. And as you walk by, it goes, click. And it's not, "Well, hello, sweetie." No, it is.
"You don't know the power of the dark side."
That's what it is. I'm telling you, that's what it is. So what's Walmart up to? Nobody knows. But this is what is possible, among other things. So it's our I Hate Walmart alert for the day.
I hate Walmart. I hate Walmart. If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big company sell the low cost. Drive mom and pop out of bed. Bring a suit all over the land. One big square store. I'd stand up a brand, and that's why.
In fact, this building, they say, when it was under construction, pouring foundation, Sam walked across the parking lot one day and said, let's add a third floor and put some people in there. No, it's built on bedrock and designed to withstand most natural and man-made disasters. Changes have been made to increase the integrity of the structure. The data center was designed with backup generators, fuel on site, room and board for a skeleton crew in the event an emergency required an extended stay. Holy cow. They've done everything but build a small city in the side of a mountain so Dick Cheney can live there, which, by the way, the feds have done. Amazing. What Walmart is up to, bush planting, fake news stories. Just a quick recap of the news. The Think Fast from thinkprogress.org. Climate researchers at Purdue University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Separately, these are two separate reports that have come out in the last 24 hours. Two solid scientific reports, Purdue University and MIT. Climate researchers, these are not paid shills of ExxonMobil. These are climate researchers at these two major universities. Global warming is causing stronger hurricanes. So the next time some bozo says, well, we're not seeing any direct effect of global warming, and you say, tell that to the people in New Orleans, and they say, well, you don't know about that. Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. Stronger hurricanes, longer hurricane season. Tomorrow, by the way, the first day of hurricane season. It's here. City and state officials, meanwhile, in hurricane-prone areas are pushing a save-yourself approach. Save yourself? Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, hold on to your hats when I ask conservative Tim Graham if there's credible evidence that Jesus could have been married or gay. Voting alert, Dave Berman is here on the theft of the American vote. That and more and your calls. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.